My dad works in B2B marketing. He came by my school for career day and said he was a big ROAS man. Then he told everyone how much he loved calculating his return on ad spend. My friends still laugh at me to this day.
Not everyone gets B2B, but with LinkedIn, you'll be able to reach people who do. Get a $100 credit on your next ad campaign. Go to linkedin.com/results to claim your credit. That's linkedin.com/results. Terms and conditions apply. LinkedIn, the place to be. To be.
From the mind of a 2-foot-tall talking Spunks puppet comes this year's biggest challenge. It's time for Bob's Dare to Compare. The hottest game show on TV that asks, what happens when you compare Bob's to the competition? You get style. You get quality. You get beeps and boops and dings and whomps. And thousands of dollars in savings. Everyone's a winner when you dare to compare with Bob's Discount Furniture. Shop in-store or at mybobs.com to play now.
As a parent, you always want to set your child up for success. So when they're struggling in school or they need help with homework, you try your best to step up. But sometimes you might not be equipped to answer. And it's better to leave that to the experts from IXL Learning. IXL Learning is an online learning program for kids. It covers math, language arts, science, and social studies. IXL can help your child really understand and master topics in a fun way with positive feedback. Powered by advanced algorithms, IXL gives the right help to each kid, no matter the age or personality. And when you sign up, one subscription gets you everything you need for all the kids in your home, from pre-K to 12th grade. IXL is used in 95 of the top 100 school districts in the U.S., with 1 in 4 students across the country using the program. So don't wait any longer. Make an impact on your child's learning. Get IXL now. And listeners can get an exclusive 20% off IXL membership when they sign up today at IXLLearning.com/audio. Visit IXLLearning.com/audio to get the most effective learning program out there at the best price.
Well, Diane, it's March, and I think, you know, this time of the year, we're always talking about St. Patrick's Day and stuff of that nature. But one of the more interesting stories, I think, out there comes from the Civil War. And when you and I were born, I was born in 1977. You were born, obviously, well after that, many, many years after I was born. And we weren't alive when Civil War people were alive. But, God, I remember my dad telling me a story when he was a kid about maybe meeting somebody from the Civil War or something like that. It could have been an old wives' tale. It could have been in an old story. But looking at Civil War history and hearing that one of the last remaining Civil War soldiers actually lived in the Kansas City area is pretty remarkable. And his name is George Washington Johnson. And a couple of things come to mind immediately about his name. Number one, was everybody named after presidents back then? And number two on this, I thought maybe this is where Johnson County, Kansas came from. Obviously, I'm wrong about this, but this dude fought in the Civil War and lived well into the 1900s, 1950s.
I know, it's crazy. I, you know, first of all, when I decided to do this story, it was Black History Month, right? Just last month, Black History Month. And I thought this would be just such a cool story to do. And then I should have known better. And here's why. Well, one, Black history is complicated, first and foremost. And second, his name is George Johnson. Like, talk about having to go through some newspapers and comb out some stuff, because there's plenty of George Johnsons in the world. Mm-hmm. So that was real fun. But yeah, he didn't live here really until later in his life, but being one of the last Civil War vets that lived, and there were a lot of liars out there too. That's something I figured out pretty quick too. Like when they talk about the last Civil War heroes and the last Civil War vets that died in X states and all this, some of it isn't even backed up by actual records from the Civil War. Like people just like made it up. One of them was actually in Missouri, living outside of St. Louis. And like they, you know, he was always, the Memorial Day parade would be around him and all. And now I'll just say this, now they're pretty sure he was a fraud. So, you know, people were like claiming to be Civil War vets. And I mean, if you think about it, just talking about documentation in general, how did you prove who you were? You know, like we have social security cards, we have driver's licenses, we have birth certificates. What did they have? Nothing, you know? Right. So it's kind of word of mouth in a way. And yeah, he was a really interesting guy. Born 1847 on Independence Day. He said he was born in Washington, D.C., and he said he was born free. That should be, I should be able to find him. And I did find a guy who matched kind of up to him in the 1850 census, because since he was not enslaved, he should have been listed in the census. But, you know, kind of looking into what he talked about in his early life and what he said he did, it didn't really match up. He said later in his life, and this tells me he didn't want to talk about his early life, that he didn't remember his parents' names. But he said he was born free. And then he also said that he had a twin brother and that he ran away from home. So again, I'm not sure, you know, it's hard to piece together the stuff, but what we do know is that he did learn to read and write. Whether he went to school or not is a question mark, but his daughter said he was a prolific reader. He loved to read. So he ends up in 1847, after he was born, they end up, you know, and I don't know if you know this, in Kansas, they're the first Kansas colored infantry is very well known in world, or I should say American history. They were the first ones to ever actually have a skirmish in the Civil War. And they were kind of illegally formed by Jim Lane. So at first, because of the government's mandates, they said that African-Americans couldn't serve in the Civil War. Well, you know, as the Civil War was going on, troops were few and far between, they had to look at their numbers and decided we need to enlist more people. And so that's when they decided that they thought that maybe enlisting African Americans was a good idea. But that didn't happen until after the Emancipation Proclamation. So we're talking 1863 now. And of course, African Americans are lining up. So in Washington, D.C., there's about 10,000 freedmen. He's going to be one of them. He's about 5'4" tall. He's only 14 years old. This is what's crazy to me. Like, I mean, how old is your daughter, Bob? Would you let her enlist in a war?
No, absolutely not. But I think what's different as I was reading your article, Diane, is that the first thing that I immediately thought of was this guy's 16 years old, 14 years old, whatever it is, and he's joining the army. And mm-hmm. I'm thinking back then when you were 14, 15, 16, a lot of times you were the head of your household by then. Like people died really early back then. And being 16 years old and going off to war back then, probably like somebody, what, in their late 20s, early 30s now, in kind of lifespan years, that would go off to war at that point in time. So like 16 is like 16 was elderly, if you will, back in the day. Like you look at 16-year-old kids right now, they don't know how to go to the bathroom by themselves or pick up their socks. But back in the 1800s, 16-year-old kids were running their household and they were the main breadwinners and they were going off to war. So I think we hear 16 and we don't understand how different 16 really was.
Oh, you had to be
100 years ago.
Right. You had to be a lot more, you know, mature for sure. And then also, it's depending, regardless of whether he was with his family or not, which I cannot. I mean, I think at some point his family was in Alexandria, Virginia, and then also in Washington, D.C. Regardless of where his family was at, if you were an African-American family, you were not making the same wages, you know, that a white family would. And so most of your family, even if you were still together, everybody would have had to have worked. Women would be washing, you know, washing clothes. Men would be hopefully getting an apprenticeship of some sort so they could learn a skilled trade. But and it's kind of, you know, he says early in his records, it says that he's basically a waiter at a saloon. And then it says that he was a butcher, and that would be a skilled trade. So, you know, I see butcher a couple times. So that's pretty interesting that he says this. And I mean, enlisting in the war, this is a way also to make money. I mean, you know, not and fight for freedom. So because they're going to pay the soldiers. Now, this is interesting, too, is that when they decided in 1863, they decided that they were going to allow African-Americans to enlist in the war. Part of the reason they didn't want to do this, too, is that so many of them were escaped slaves from the South, and they didn't want to, I mean, the damage had already been done, but they didn't want to piss anybody else off. So in 1863, the 1st Regiment of the District of Columbia Colored Infantry was born. And at that point, George Washington Johnson is basically 16, like you said, and he decides to enlist in this war. And lies about his age because mm-hmm. you can't live till you're 18.
It's funny because my grandfather did that to get into World War II. He said he was 18 And he was 17 years old, and they let him go into World War II. Like, I mean, again, those are the stories we were told. Yeah. You know, you would think by World War II, they would have some record on this kind of stuff. But my dad to this day, I'll go, your grandfather lied about his age to go fight for his country. And I'm like, people did that back then. Like, people don't even want to join the military today, seriously, let alone lie about their age to go into the military.
You're right. I know. And that's the whole idea of patriotism, too. I mean, you know, we kind of saw that resurgence in our lifetime, because I remember my parents saying, like, you don't know what it's like, you know, because they've been through, at least for baby boomers, World War II. And then for us, they had Vietnam. Right. Mm-hmm. And then when it comes to our generation, my dad was serving as a lieutenant colonel in the Air National Guard and went to Desert Storm. So I was actually the child, you know, without the dad. And I learned about patriotism then because my dad wasn't here, you know. But really what did it for us was 9/11. Right. And we look at patriotism now. And I think, I don't want to say we need a 9/11. We don't. But I think that this next generation hasn't seen what we've seen, you know, to see all those people go off and enlist. And that would have been the same case for this, for George Washington Johnson. This was a chance for him to get away from home. This is a chance for him to serve his country and make money. And the treatment of the Union Army wasn't equal. Black soldiers were paid $10 a month and they were charged $3 for their clothes. So they gave them actually $7 a month.
Right.
And then in comparison, white soldiers were paid $13 a month and they were given $3.50 for clothes.
Yeah, it's now crazy how that happened because, mm-hmm, you know, when I was reading about that, I'm like, wait a second here. So there was still discrimination in the army, even in the Union Army, you know, like in the North, there was discrimination in the army as well. I mean, I'm thinking to myself, why are we doing this? Guys want to come fight for their country. Let's treat everybody the same.
Well, they ended up actually back paying them. So in general, in general, they ended up back paying. So they end up recuperating that money to a point. But you're right. Like, you know, a life is a life. But you got to remember, you know, that they didn't count African-Americans even as full humans, you know, in the South at this time. So he ends up serving in this regiment and they enlist. And I think this is really interesting. This is Washington, D.C.'s regiment. So they're going to be right there at the Capitol and right there in the where Abraham Lincoln is. And they were so scared for their safety that they put them on Mason's Island, which is now Roosevelt Island. So on the Potomac in the middle of it, they're like an island. And they put the soldiers there to keep them away so people, you know, couldn't get to them and you know, kill them or fight mm-hmm. them or anything like this. It was so secretive that the president of the United States didn't even know where they were. I mean, like, that's how contentious it was. And I mean, even the mortality rates for Black soldiers was way higher, 35% higher in Black regiments, just mortality during the Civil War, not from fighting, because they really didn't want their African Americans in the line of battle, because that would be, again, kind of throwing it at the South. It was from disease and treatments and how they were living, which is just terrible. So he actually did see some action here and there, but it was an accident. They were building up some fort, Wilson's Wharf, and end up running into Robert E. Lee's nephew. And he was all mad when he saw, like, because they ended up winning, even though they had more soldiers. The Confederacy had more soldiers. They ended up winning. And he, like, walked away all angry, right? Because these Black regiments beat him. And of course, that's kind of, again, we go a little bit of folklore history there, because there's not a lot of, you know, evidence on that. In all, in the end of the Civil War, 172,000 Black troops enlisted and 10% lost their lives. George Washington Johnson gets out in 1865 and he decides to run away from home. He says he's going to run away from his brothers. We have no names, whatever. But he talks multiple times about how he decides to go to Baltimore and get on a ship and go to London. So here is this freedman leaving the United States and going to London. And he gets on this rickety ship. And once he gets there, like, we're going to take this, you know, ship to Bombay. And he's like, this thing's not going to make it to Bombay. He's like, I'm out. So he leaves and he walks to Liverpool And then he gets on another ship, he gets a job and comes back to the United States. Like, what? And I do believe that happened. I mean, he mentions it more than once. And then he ends up moving. And this is kind of a Kansas City / Midwest thing. We have the Exodusters. We have an exodus of African Americans that move from the South because of, you know, Jim Crow and everything else. Right. And there's an exodus to Kansas, but he actually ends up in Little Rock, Arkansas in 1870, and he's working as a butcher again. He's in Arkansas, and he says he goes to Texas for a while. And then I think that those two locations were not exactly friendly. So he ends up moving to Leavenworth, Kansas. And that would be, he would have been in Leavenworth, Kansas before the Exodusters movement, which, you know, history tells us that in the 1880s, essentially, that the Reconstruction failure in the South lured people to move to Kansas, and they predominantly moved to the northwestern or northeastern portion of Kansas. So Leavenworth, Topeka, Lawrence, et cetera. They lured to them out of there because of racial tensions and settled in Kansas. And Kansas City, Kansas was another place they went. So he ends up being one of these guys. And he I think during the war, he trained as a carpenter. And so he ends up being a carpenter's apprentice up in Leavenworth and gets married. You know, now he's got his whole little life going on. Everything looks great, except he keeps losing his wives.
Yeah, lost three of them, right?
He did, poor guy. Yeah. He got married really late in his life. And, you know, his first wife died, Emma. She died. And I don't think they had any kids. And then his second wife, Josella, she was born free and actually came from West of Missouri, which is pretty interesting. So she would have been one of the freed people of West of Missouri. He marries her and they have a daughter. So their daughter is born. It's the only child he has. And so he ends up with a daughter named Josephine. And Josephine Lee. And then he ends up marrying, after his wife dies, he marries Celia. And Celia was also, I think, born free or close to. And she was from Platte County, Missouri. So he's up north for, you know, in Leavenworth for a period of time. And the reason he hits Kansas City's scene is a couple different reasons. Well, one, he comes to Kansas City because I think his daughter moves to Kansas City. So that's his predominant role. And the reason we know he comes to Kansas City, even though he was in the soldier's home up in Lawrence, I mean, the guy even worked, or Lawrence in Leavenworth, the guy even like was put in there because he had like bronchitis. And I sympathize with that right now, bronchitis and some other stuff. And he goes to the soldier's home, which was established, you know, by the GAR, which is the Grand Army of the Republic. Those are the veterans of the Civil War. He goes up there because he's sick and he stays for a couple months. And then he ends up staying for like 5 years, just working, helping the vets out, you know, just kind of like that.
Kind of give him back, right?
Yeah. Unsung heroes of the Civil War, like I said. So he ends up in Kansas City late in his life. And that's his wife, Celia, his third wife, is very active in like fraternal orders and clubs and stuff like that. I think that's the only reason he got involved in like being a part of the GAR. And for people that don't know what the GAR, it's a fraternal organization for veterans of the Union. And, you know, it got established right after the Civil War, and it became, there were thousands of posts, kind of like you see like the Elks Lodge today, like thousands of posts. The whole point was that you joined if you were a vet. And so he ends up joining a post in Kansas City. And then as time goes on, these vets are dying off. And I mean, this is where it just becomes absolutely crazy to me. He ends up, GAR's peak membership in the 1890s is about 400,000 members. And he didn't join until the late 1880s. And then what it really gets him on the headlines is in 1938. So he's up there now. I mean, he's up there. He's born in 1847, or that's what he said. He's invited to this reunion at the Battle of Gettysburg. So it's the anniversary of the Battle of Gettysburg. Now, 75th anniversary of Battles of Gettysburg. They're not just inviting people who fought, you know, at Battle of Gettysburg. There were like three of them left. They're inviting everyone. So they're inviting everyone who is a vet. And he gets this beautiful invitation, engraved invitation from the Secretary of War in the mail saying, hey, we'll pay your expenses. You can come up here for the anniversary of Battle of Gettysburg. He's like, cool, let's go.
I'm going. But so think about that, though. 75 years after a Civil War battle, and there's still people around.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I mean, God.
I know. And I mean, you're living, like, how long you were expected to live was so much lower then.
Right.
And you fought in a battle. These guys, it's not like they, you know, lived like the high life. They were like scrum, like horrible conditions.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah. So he is one of, this is really interesting. He was told to be an active and stylish dresser. So he gets his nice little clothes out and stuff, and he gets on the train at Union Station. He's going to go to this, you know, battle event July 3rd through 5th in 1938. And he says, when all those firecrackers go off at Gettysburg, they're going off because it's my birthday. I love him. So, you know, so he goes and all of this. 1,800 veterans of the 8,000 survivors attend. So they invited 8,000 veterans, and only 1,800 were probably healthy enough to attend.
Sure, at that time. You know? I mean, you're talking probably about people who are it's
95
80s,
90s.
I mean, yeah, like think about it, because essentially you were fighting at the, you know, 16 to 18, 75 years later. Do the math, you're in your 90s.
Oh, my God. I mean, it's absurd to me to think that that many people were like, let's go.
And then living that long, again, is remarkable that there were that many people available.
What's even crazier is at the 75th anniversary, two of the people that came to it died while they were there.
Oh, my God.
Sorry, it's not funny, but they like made it up there and they passed away during the event.
Oh, my goodness. But this guy made it till he was 98 years old. I mean,
I know.
Like I'm reading a book right now about, you know, kind of extending your life. And it's like they're interviewing like people who have lived over 100 and what they did. And most of them smoke and drink. Right. And they're like,
oh, yeah.
How did you live that long? And, you know, who the hell knows? Right. So they're doing all this research to figure out how to maintain yourself. This is in 2024. OK, this book was written a couple of years ago, but we're talking about 1938. I mean, if you're walking around in your 90s, you are a remarkable human being at that point in time, right? Like you should be studied if you're in your 90s back then.
Oh, absolutely. And I think that they did study them because they wanted to know, this is the part, and it was hard for me to find these statistics first, and I figured out kind of how to do it, but you know, they wanted to know how long vets would live because the Veterans Administration needed to pay them.
Yeah,
so they're like, we got to formulate how long these people are going to live. We need to know how much money we have, whatever. And so they did a lot more studies after World War One. They did a lot more studies about the survivability of these vets. And I mean, I think he lived through World War One. And he was there. World War II going. I know. One of his birthday presents to himself was buying a war bond for the World War II. I mean, just like mind boggling.
Yeah.
Just to give you an idea, 1939. Well, and I should say the Battle of Gettysburg reunion, there's a lot of photos. There's actually a video of it. And I bet he's in it because he was one of three Black soldiers that attended.
Wow.
Three. That's crazy.
That's insane.
It's insane. So he comes back to Kansas City, and then he's now like kind of one of the last survivors in Missouri. So he's invited to all sorts of events. 1941, he was, he got to meet the first brigadier general, first Black brigadier general, general of the army. He got to meet him and shake his hand, and the Kansas City Call talks about how much progress they'd made. And I mean, it's still 1941. We haven't hit the civil rights movement yet, you know?
Mm-hmm.
He is just, he was the last Civil War vet living in Kansas City, period. So in 1945, August 1st, 98, he passes away at his home at 23rd in Michigan. And he was the chairman emeritus of the Memorial Day parade. He was known in Kansas City. And again, he didn't really, you know, talk about the Civil War or you know, be a part of this, the celebrations and the GAR and all of these things until his third wife, who was really active. And so we didn't, you know, 1890s to the 1940s, until he died, he was more active as a Civil War vet. And that's how, you know, of course, the paper would talk about him because he was the only one left. But when he died, you know, that was the last branch of the GAR closed. He was the last guy here. Mm-hmm. So after, you know, 250 people went to his celebration of his life, and they talked about how he fought for freedom, even though he was already free. And at the close of the Civil War, this is just some statistics. And this is talks about veterans today, too. 2.2 million veterans walked off battlefields to the back to their lives. 2.2 million. In 1918, 300,000 were still alive. So at the end of World War One, that's how many were still alive. Then in 1945, before George passed away, there were 240 veterans from the Civil War alive in the entire country, world. Okay. Out of 3 million who served. It's like, what? A year later, after he passed away, there were only 154 left. Wow. They were dropping fast, right?
Yeah.
In Missouri, the last veteran died 4 days after his 105th birthday in 1951. In Kansas, the last veteran also died in 1951 at the age of 102. And then the final Civil War vet in the entire United States that can be documented as Albert Woolson died in 1956 at 109 in Minnesota. And so one of the things they talked about is the VA predicting, I've read a lot about this, when the last World War vet would be gone. They were like, when's the last World War vet going to be gone? They said they're going to be gone by 1995. And I was like, let's just see. So little could one predict that the last veteran of World War One would die in 2011. Wow. At the age of 110. So hard lives, fighting for your country. Don't question how long they're going to live, because they probably have more in them than we do.
My dad works in B2B marketing. He came by my school for career day and said he was a big ROAS man. Then he told everyone how much he loved calculating his return on ad spend. My friends still laugh at me to this day.
Not everyone gets B2B, but with LinkedIn, you'll be able to reach people who do. Get a $100 credit on your next ad campaign. Go to linkedin.com/results to claim your credit. That's linkedin.com/results. Terms and conditions apply. LinkedIn, the place to be. To be.
From the mind of a 2-foot-tall talking spunks puppet comes this year's biggest challenge. It's time for Bob's Dare to Compare, the hottest game show on TV that asks, what happens when you compare Bob's to the competition? You get style. You get quality. You get beeps and boops and dings and whomps. And thousands of dollars in savings. Everyone's a winner when you dare to compare with Bob's Discount Furniture. Shop in store or at mybobs.com to play now.
As a parent, you always want to set your child up for success. So when they're struggling in school or they need help with homework, you try your best to step up. But sometimes you might not be equipped to answer. And it's better to leave that to the experts from IXL Learning. IXL Learning is an online learning program for kids. It covers math, language arts, science, and social studies. IXL can help your child really understand and master topics in a fun way with positive feedback. Powered by advanced algorithms, IXL gives the right help to each kid, no matter the age or personality. And when you sign up, one subscription gets you everything you need for all the kids in your home, from pre-K to 12th grade. IXL is used in 95 of the top 100 school districts in the U.S., with 1 in 4 students across the country using the program. So don't wait any longer. Make an impact on your child's learning. Get IXL now. And listeners can get an exclusive 20% off IXL membership when they sign up today at IXLLearning.com/audio. Visit IXLLearning.com/audio to get the most effective learning program out there at the best price.
In the fast-paced world of attacking, speed is everything. And that's where the Furon 7 Plus shines. Engineered for accuracy and precision at a rapid pace, it's your secret weapon on the pitch. Experience overall comfort and precise striking, even in the game's fastest moments. The nylon outsole, with its V-shaped stud configuration, is designed for firm ground, giving you the grip you need to outmaneuver your opponents. Step up your attacking game and learn more and purchase the Furon at NewBalance.com.
Oh, 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 O'Reilly! Protect your vehicle's engine with a full synthetic oil change and save with Mobil 1 at O'Reilly Auto Parts. Purchase 5 quarts of Mobil 1 full synthetic motor oil and receive a $10 O'Reilly gift card after rebate. See store for details. With your Mobil 1 purchase, you'll also receive 2x points during Old Rewards Bonus Points Month at O'Reilly Auto Parts.
O'Reilly Auto Parts.